hip-hop during a free lobby concert. For more information, visit GrantArtCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. On this first hour of the show today, we'll be taking your questions on personal finance, money management. It's something that we do every month on the show, always on a Friday. And our guest is David Sineau. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. And for a long time now, he's been stopping by to do the show. He begins by making a few comments. And then if you have questions on whatever it is that he will be talking about, or anything else that has to do with financial planning, money management, investing. I always like to say, no matter whether it's you're thinking about your retirement, you're thinking about sending your kids to college, whatever it is, and you're thinking about your strategies to do that, I know that Dave will do his best to help you out. At least he can give you some advice, and you can add that to your store of knowledge. But for now, I'll be quiet and say, welcome back to the show. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David, and of course, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And let me extend a very warm holiday greeting to all of our listeners of WILL. My opening comments will really cover two specific areas. First, I want to talk about our rapidly escalating debt crisis at the federal level and its financial consequences. And second, each month now, we're going to review what I call our couch potato portfolio, our year-to-date results, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about actively managed fund investing versus indexing. I think it was more than 30 years ago when now-deceased Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois uttered those famous words, a billion here and a billion there, well, now you're talking some real money. I see you just kind of smiling over there, David. Well, today, perhaps a more appropriate comment might be a trillion here and a trillion there, and now you are indeed talking some real money. And that is clearly the feeling of Mr. David Walker, our nation's comptroller general. He is our nation's chief accountant, if you will, and annually signs off on the federal government's balance sheet. Recently, Mr. Walker, who I don't think is exactly a household name, was quoted as follows, America's fiscal future is worse than advertised. Now, we've all heard the saying, just the facts, ma'am. Well, here they are. Fact number one, in fiscal year ending September 30th, 2005, the federal government spent $319 billion more than it collected in revenue. I guess that's all of us because really are the federal government. Fact number two, our national debt has far surpassed that fancy number known as $8 trillion. Fact number three, the real problem is not the $8 trillion deficit. The real problem is unfunded or underfunded government liabilities, which include public debt and promised Medicare, Social Security, and other middle-class entitlements to scores of millions of Americans. When Mr. Walker reports these numbers on December 15, 2005, that total of underfunded and unfunded liabilities promised to the American public sometime in the future is now expected to surpass $45 trillion. Fact number four, of our current $8 trillion of national debt, the government owes itself approximately $3 trillion, such as owing itself money to the highway trust funds. But the actual amount of money that must be financed in the capital markets globally all over the world approximates $5 trillion. And a further fact, almost half of this $5 trillion of U.S. Treasury debt, after all, that's how we finance it, is now held by non-U.S. parties, especially the governments of Japan and the governments of China. Fact number five, most economists, including Alan Greenspan, believe that the American taxpayers won't ever be able to pay for these now promised benefits of Social Security, Medicare, and other middle class entitlements promised over the next 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years and beyond. Fact number six, in 1985, federal spending on all social entitlement programs, which of course included Social Security and Medicare, ate up 45% of the federal budget. It now takes 56% of our federal budget. And with the coming retirement of baby boomers, I guess that's me, and an aging population, again, I guess that's me, conservative estimates suggest a decade from now, it will take 62% of all collected revenues just to deal with social programming. Fact number 7, our balance of trade deficit now approximates $50 billion, that's B with a billion, per month. In other words, we are importing approximately $50 billion more of goods and services every month than we export. As a result, many countries, and particularly China and Japan, have very positive trade balances with the United States. And especially in the case of China, the Chinese government invests this excess cash that they receive right back into the United States. How do they do it? They buy our U.S. treasuries. And as a result of these countries, specifically China, for example, buying our U.S. treasuries, they, one, provide the U.S. with a ready source of cash to fund our voracious appetite for consumer goods and government spending. And many of those consumer goods, of course, are produced in China. And two, this allows us to continue to deficit spend and even create larger deficits. Well, as you can see, that's some pretty sobering news, and it's a bit of a vicious cycle. And let's face it, Congress on both sides of the aisle have really exercised very little fiscal restraint. We just heard 5 minutes ago on NPR National News that there weren't going to be any funding cuts in programs. No, Democrats and Republicans joined together saying we better not cut back anymore. And the big battle in Congress is going to be over these taxes and income taxes. Should we extend these income taxes and these income tax cuts? So we've got to blame ourselves. We have to blame everybody, including Congress, the administration, and specifically ourselves, the voters, for these financial state of affairs. But you know, it's interesting. In spite of rising interest rates that we're all aware of, rising mortgage rates that we all know about, retail inflation now running at about a 4.7% annualized rate, a deteriorating deficit, in spite of all of this, the U.S. stock market continues to display an amazing resilience, which of course leads me into a discussion of my couch potato portfolio. You'll recall that each month I promise to report on the annualized rate of return of this portfolio, which includes dividends. First, I want to review with you the composition of the portfolio, which is really made up of index funds. They happen to be Vanguard index funds, but they are available elsewhere through other mutual fund companies as well. Sometimes I refer to them as asset class funds. You'll recall that the composition is 10% S&P 500, 15% large value, 10% the Russell 2000 index, which often is referred to as the small cap index, the 15% in small cap value, 10% in the mid caps, 10% in REITs. Those are real estate investment trusts. So if you want to be in the real estate business and not be in the landlord business, you can invest through REITs. 20% outside of the U.S. in the total international Vanguard index, and 10% in the Vanguard emerging markets index. Well, through last night's close, how has this portfolio performed year to date in spite of what seems to be all kinds of economic issues both in the U.S. and globally? That portfolio, ladies and gentlemen, is up 8.87% for the year through last night's close. And obviously, that's a pretty darn handsome rate of return in a very, very choppy stock market, in a very, very choppy financial world. It's interesting to note that investors are now barraged with more than 17,000 mutual fund choices. Can you imagine such a thing? And very frankly, it's a virtual impossibility to follow more than just a handful of funds on a daily basis. I suspect that's a major reason for the popularity of all kinds of publication services who supposedly do the work for you and inform you about the pros and the cons of various mutual funds. However, let's keep in mind something. Regardless of the quality of research performed by an investment service company, their reports, their recommendations are based on yesterday's news and yesterday's fund performances. There is little, if any, ability of these services to predict winning and losing funds in the future, especially if the funds are 1. Actively managed, 2. They have substantial portfolio turnover, and 3. They undergo investment management change at the top. In other words, investment manager roulette, as it's known in the industry. And that is a major reason, ladies and gentlemen, that I continue to index as an investment strategy. Indexing avoids the problems of rapid portfolio turnover. Indexing avoids management changes. After all, it's based upon a mathematical model. And indexing, perhaps most importantly, avoids high mutual fund expenses. So as a result, over a long period of time, an indexing strategy clearly lands your portfolio in the top quartile of the performance of all mutual funds. And I think my goal, when I really think about it, is to continue to hit singles and doubles on the baseball playing field and avoiding the big-time route, the 12-to-nothings, the 15-to-nothing routes, and pursue that time-honored strategy of slow but steady wins the race. Well, there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to tackle questions about our economy from our listeners on these topics I've raised, or, of course, other financial questions on the minds of our listeners.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois, the College of Business. And once a month, he's here on Friday, and we talk about investing in money management. It's wide open. Whatever sorts of questions you might have, I know he will do his best to help you out, to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just real quick, because you were talking about changes in tax law that have come about over the last couple of years. And not very long ago, I had in here Richard Kaplan, professor of law at U of I, who knows an awful lot about taxes.
Awful lot about taxes and elder law.
And we talked a little bit about some of the recommendations that this tax task force that the president created. He talked about it first in his State of the Union address this year, and they made a number of recommendations of changes. One thing that we didn't talk about, I'm just curious about, is capital gains. Over there, the legislation was passed by the Congress that over a period of time phases out the capital gains tax. But it's one of these deals where it goes down and down and down and down and then to nothing. However, the day after that, if the Congress doesn't do anything, it goes exactly back to where it was.
Sort of like estate planning.
I wonder for people who pay attention to this, is the thinking that Congress certainly is not going to let it go back to what it was, but the question would be then, I guess, would it make the elimination of the capital gains tax permanent? Does anybody have some feeling about where, or is somewhere in between there, where that's going to go?
Well, here's my feeling about it. Money ends up where money is treated best. It's an old saying. And capital flows to where money is treated best. And most countries in the world do not have a capital gains tax. All right? The U.S. is one of the few that has a capital gains tax. So as we become a more global economy and companies are moving capital all over the world, guess what? They're going to be investing and moving capital into places where they're not going to be paying capital gains tax. So the question becomes, is a 15% capital gains tax enough of an incentive to move that capital globally? And I think the answer is clearly yes. Mm-hmm. So there is going to be continued downward pressure, in my view, on the capital gains tax. Also, interestingly enough, every time that the capital gains tax has been lowered, more and more assets are freed up. In other words, people sell assets, pay their capital gains tax, and guess what happens? More dollars come into the federal coffers than before. So it's not like we're not going to have dollars flowing into the corporate coffers, into the tax coffers, if we reduce the capital gains tax. Indeed, precisely the opposite has happened. The big problem is that every time we seem to have more revenue coming into the federal government, guess what? between the administration and Congress and ourselves, we quickly find a way to spend it and even exceed it.
Yeah. The other thing that we did indeed talk about when Professor Kaplan was here was some of the changes that are recommended and the fact that this commission has now recommended either eliminating or capping some of the most popular deductions. They want to put a cap on the deduction for home mortgage interest. They want to eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes. They also want to place limits on your deduction for your charitable contribution. I think, if I remember right, it has to be more than 1% of your income to be able to take the deduction. And they're also talking about making some changes in in brackets and rates. But the thing that I'm sure that would get a lot of people's attention would be the changes to these deductions that are very widely used.
Absolutely.
For mortgage and taxes.
Actually, I believe the number is something like 40 million Americans itemize on their tax return. I'm not sure of that number, but it's sort of a number that sticks in my mind. And what are the major itemized deductions? Well, they are indeed home mortgage interest, all right, charitable contributions, and in most cases, state income tax. Mm-hmm. Now, in Illinois, where we have a 3% state income tax, that deduction, while it may be very worthwhile, is not quite the same as where you are in New York,
or California.
Where that might be a 9, 10, or 11% number of gross income. And believe me, those people are going to fight long and hard to keep that particular itemized deduction.
Mm. Well, let's talk with some folks here. We have a caller in Urbana. Start us off, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about my investment. And the company and the person who does my investments paints me a very glowing picture of how this money's going to increase. But on the other hand, when I get the statements, I don't see that. And I'm wondering if there's somebody I can go to for a second opinion about this.
Well, there
who
are always people.
To?
There are always people out there for second opinions. You can typically find certified financial planners, and those would be people who could look at your portfolio. I'm a little reticent to recommend just a brokerage firm, for example, because they typically will try to convince you to move your assets
yes.
to that particular brokerage firm.
Right.
So you're really looking for an independent investment advisor who would charge you on an hourly basis
mm-hmm.
to look at your money. And I think probably the best thing to do is to look for someone who is a certified financial planner. You can typically find those people because they are listed. Interestingly enough, even in the Yellow Pages, they list under financial planners if they are a certified financial planner. And if they are not willing to look at your portfolio, often they can make a recommendation to you of one or two other individuals or companies who would give you an independent evaluation of your portfolio. So that's what I would suggest.
Okay, so a certified
financial planner.
Financial planner.
That's correct. A CFP.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
All right. And, well, let's go to line two for another Urbana caller. Line two. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I wondered if it ever makes sense to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, not particularly for tax considerations, but because with the Roth IRA, the withdrawal, you have much more freedom in how you withdraw the money?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. There are a lot of good reasons if you are in a financial position to convert a traditional into a Roth. First of all, with a Roth, there is no requirement of taking minimum distributions. So that's important. You could be in your 70s, 80s, 90s, and there is no requirement to take money out of a Roth IRA. So many, many people use a Roth IRA as an excellent estate planning tool. Secondly, as we all know, with Roth IRA money, once we begin taking money out of a Roth IRA, typically after 59 and a half, that money that comes out on a tax-free basis as opposed to a taxable basis. And many older Americans are finding out when they take money out of their pension funds, when they take money out of their IRA funds, that their income tax burden is extremely arduous. It is very, very high. And in addition to that, after taking these minimum distributions out of pension funds, 401ks, traditional IRAs, and perhaps they are also receiving Social Security, they find that their Social Security income is being taxed at an effective 20 to 25% rate as well. So there are definitely some benefits. Now, of course, if you convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, and I'm presuming in the traditional IRA it has always been a tax-deferred IRA. In other words, you got a tax break for going right into it, and the earnings are growing tax-deferred. When you convert that to a Roth IRA, that gives an immediate rise to an income tax impact. All right? So if you converted a $10,000 traditional to a $10,000 Roth, that $10,000 must be reported on your federal income tax return in the upcoming year. So you've got to pay immediate tax on it. But on the other hand, if you have a substantially strong life expectancy remaining, and especially for young people, it makes good sense. Now, not everyone is eligible, however, to convert to a Roth IRA from a traditional IRA. There are income restraints. And while I don't remember them off the top of my head, it's approximately $100,000. So if your adjusted gross income is in excess of $100,000, you may not be eligible, if you will, and adjusted for inflation, to convert. But if your income is less than that, and after checking with your tax advisor, you probably are eligible to convert, and then you've got to look at the tax impact. Something else, you don't have to convert it all at once.
Yeah.
All right? So you could dollar cost average out of it, if you will, to reduce the income tax burden. But overall, even as a faculty member at the University of Illinois, when I talk to my kids, they're really not kids, they're students because they're all seniors, but I sort of think of them as kids. I said, you know, you ought to get out there and start investing for your own retirement, and probably the best vehicle is a Roth IRA. So I'm very, very high on a Roth IRA, but we have to stay tuned because there are lots of legislative proposals suggesting other kinds of savings devices in addition to the Roth IRA. Maybe the Roth is even going to be eliminated. It's not clear at this point in time. But in the meantime, we need to take advantage of that particular investment. Mm-hmm. Now, does that answer your question?
So you have to pay tax on your contributions as well as any gains that occur?
Well, that's right. Assuming that you, when you made your original contributions, did you take a tax deduction on your tax return? Probably did.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be called a non-deductible IRA. And you probably did a traditional IRA where on page one of your 1040, you got an above-the-line deduction. So if you put $2,000 in or $2,500 in or $3,000, that was an immediate tax subtraction against income.
Okay, it was a government-deferred compensation program that I switched over to a traditional IRA.
Okay, so all of that money then in that traditional IRA is basically tax-deferred money, and when you pull it out, is going to be taxable.
Okay.
So now you've got that tax-deferred IRA, and you do have the option of looking at that Roth conversion.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Appreciate the program.
Very good. We are at our midpoint here, and we certainly have time for more questions. Our guest, David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at University of Illinois. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about investing in personal finance, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
David, I wanted to jump in while we've got just a moment here, and I see the phones are lighting up again. But I wanted to talk very, very quickly about interest rates and what's happening in the economy. And as we all know, that Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve have been sort of on this march, this mission, if you will, to raise short-term interest rates. And they do that by raising the target rate for the Fed funds rate, which is the overall overnight rate at which banks borrow from each other. And indeed, that rate has come up some 300 basis points or 3% over the last 24 months. So what we now have in the economy is we have short-term treasury rates. For example, a one-year treasury rate, I'm looking at yesterday's Wall Street, the ask yield on that one-year treasury was about 4.4%. And at the same time, if we go out 5 years or 10 years, the ask yield on those treasuries are about 4.5%. In other words, there's very, very little difference between short-term rates now in the economy and long-term rates in the economy. And that's called a flattening yield curve. And that can spell trouble down the road, because when we have had flattening yield curves in the past, at least of the last 10 times that we've gotten ourselves into that situation, often short-term rates surpass long-term rates, and it bodes recession on the horizon. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but I know that we have listeners also.
That's right. All right, let's talk with somebody here in Champaign. Line one.
Good morning, Professor Zeno. I hope this falls into the purview of this program. Yeah, it's kind of a money management question. I have been disturbed recently to see on my bank statements that payments, check payments I've sent in, have been converted to debits. There is no longer even an image available. I presume that the merchant is converting and destroying the check right at the source. And what protection do I have if they make a mistake and cause consequential financial harm to me?
Well, that's something that I'm not familiar with, but I'm interested in investigating it. Let me understand the facts, that you are doing business with a merchant and you are writing a check.
And mailing it in.
And mailing it in. So, in other words, if I had a bill from, oh golly, Saks Fifth Avenue, and I mailed that check in, you're saying that you're not even getting an image of that check, that it's being reported as a debit?
That is correct.
And
it has
you don't
a check number on the line, but it's reported as a debit.
All right. So it has the check number on the line, but are the rest of your checks coming through in check imaging?
Most of them, yes. Just a very few.
So does this seem to be typical with three or four companies that you're doing business with every month, for example?
It seems to be an expanding number of them. First, it was just one credit card company. Now there's a couple of local utilities that are doing it.
All right. Well, my guess is, number one, it's lawful. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be doing it. My guess is, number two, that I would be calling my bank and asking about it and whether or not there is some form or some type of paperwork that I can fill out to guarantee that I will receive a check. Absent that, I'm not certain what to do, but I'm going to check on it. I'm going to write that down and inquire at a couple of banks as to whether or not this is something that all banks are entertaining or just certain banks, etc., and what rights as a consumer do we have, because that would be very disconcerting to me as well, is simply having a number and not having a check image. And I suppose the only thing that one can do to protect themselves, if that's indeed the way things are going, is to have a carbon copy of your own check when you write it. But that's very expensive, it's messy, and it's not very user-friendly. So you've raised something, one, I'm not aware of, and two, I will check into. And if you check into it also, I'd be interested to know what results that you come up with as well. Have you already checked into it?
No, I haven't. I can do that at lunchtime, though.
Okay. Well, it would be interesting to know those results, and I presume that you would start with your own bank.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you for that inquiry, and I've written it down to take a look into and report back next month.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Before we go any further, and I have another caller here who is holding, and we want to get right to them. Earlier on, we did have someone call in off the air and wanted to know, could you just real quick run down the makeup of your couch potato portfolio and how it is you're allocating the money?
That's right. I'll be happy to do that. And, of course, it's a couch potato portfolio because, one, you sit on the couch, you eat potato chips, and then you watch basketball. I think that's what we do now on the couch and watch the Illini win basketball games. Well, anyway, here it is again. I have 10% of a dollar, or 10 cents of my dollar, allocated to the S&P 500 index. That one's pretty standard. It's a benchmark type of index that almost every money manager benchmarks to. Next, I have 15 cents of my dollar in large value. So I want to attract some of the value component of those very, very large stocks. And most academic studies show that over long periods of time, value outperforms growth. So I want to have my portfolio tilted a bit more towards value than just to the S&P 500. I have 10% of my money in the Russell 2000. So we've got the 500 largest companies, and then we have the next many, many companies, and of those 2,000, that's often called the Russell 2000. Next, I have 15 cents of my money, or 15%, in the value component of that Russell 2000. It's called the Small Cap Value Index. So it's taking a portion of those particular smaller companies and looking for the value component of that particular sector of the market. 10 cents of my dollar in the mid caps. We have something called the S&P 100. Those are the 100 largest companies. And then really the next 400, or the S&P 400, are often referred to as the mid cap index. 10 cents of my dollar, 10%, are in a REIT index. That's a real estate investment trust index. It's simply an index made up of literally scores of companies that are in the business of owning real estate, managing real estate, leasing real estate, buying and selling real estate of all different kinds. 20 cents, let's start going internationally. 20% is in the Vanguard Total International Index. And what Vanguard does is that their Total International Index actually is composed of three components. It's composed a little bit, about 10% of that index is in emerging markets, about 20% of it is in the Pacific Rim, and then about 70% of it is really Europe, Australia, and the Far East. So it's a compendium of three different indexes. We call it the Total International Index. 20 cents of my dollar is in that. And then I'm just a little bit more aggressive because I'm a youngster. Heck, I'm only in my mid-50s, so I'm still a youngster. So I have my last 10 cents, or my last 10%, in the Emerging Markets Index, which is an extraordinarily volatile index. It can be up 25% one year. It could easily be down 25% another year. But interestingly enough, from a diversification standpoint, it actually enhances portfolio returns, and it actually reduces overall volatility risk, even though by itself it is an extremely risky asset class. And indeed, just this year, for example, it's up 22.7% through yesterday's close. So 10% of my money is in that one as well. If you took all of the rates of return inclusive of the dividends to date, we'd be pushing almost 9%. But of course, last month when we looked at this index, it was far, far lower.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good. Well, I hope that helps. We have some other callers here we'll get to. And first in line would be line two and someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm. Hi there.
I just had a question about IRAs.
Yes.
I don't have a lot of money in IRAs, but what I do have, most of it is in a traditional. I have a little bit in a Roth, and I just wondered, I know you had said that you had you recommend the Roth. You know, I guess my question is, you know, I've been pretty skeptical about putting a lot of money in the Roth because my understanding is that right now I can get a tax deduction if I put it in a regular, and then the Roth, it would be tax-free when you take it out. But I guess my concern is I won't be retiring for another probably 20 or 30 years. And so I thought, you know, if the laws change and they decide to, you know, start taxing it later, I guess I've just been pretty skeptical that it's just going to stay tax-free all that time. So I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, one, that's certainly a reasonable argument. And two, if you are providing yourself with a substantial income tax benefit today, it makes sense. Now, most people who can receive a tax benefit in a traditional IRA find themselves with income of less than $50,000, or in the alternative, they have income of more than $50,000, but they don't participate in any type of plan. Here's my point. If when you are looking at your benefit that you are deriving currently, if you find yourself in one of the lower income tax brackets, either 10% or 15%, that's the actual benefit you're getting, I really feel that you would be better off placing your money in a Roth IRA,
okay,
paying that 10 or 15% on that money today, placing it in a Roth IRA and letting it grow tax-free. Now, on the other hand, if you found yourself in a major tax bracket, 25, 30, 35%, somewhere in those areas, for example, then I might feel differently about it, and you would find that your traditional tax benefit today would then be worth quite a bit of money. But for married taxpayers or single taxpayers, if they find themselves in a 10 or 15% tax bracket, I really feel quite strongly that you would be better off in a Roth IRA program.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you. Let's go next to caller in Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. You mentioned about the banks, and I don't know whether it's because we have cutthroat competition in this little area where I am, but they do things for you that you don't even ask for. Like my bank all of a sudden told everybody that you have an extra $300 in your balance that you'll cover if you overdraw on writing a check. And to get rid of that, you had to, you know, I had to go down to the bank, show my identification, thanks to the Security Act, and ask them not to do that because I have enough trouble keeping my account in order, letting, instead of, you know, worrying about I've got this extra $300 I can play with, you know, if I overdraw. So I had it removed. But I just wondered, where in these silly laws does that allow them to do things like that? And the second question deals with credit cards. All of a sudden, I've noticed I paid off some cards, and I just canceled them and got rid of the account altogether. And I was told by a fellow that I shouldn't have done that, that that counts against me on my credit score. And I just wondered if you could give a few, you know, wisdom words about what helps your credit score and what doesn't help it that you think might be a sensible thing to do since you paid off a debt. Thanks.
Well, banks under federal law have the ability to offer you bells and whistles. And in fact, most people have taken advantage of that bell and whistle, although you and I have not. And the truth of the matter is it's aimed to make money because it provides consumers the opportunity to overdraw their account. And what banks typically don't tell you is that the interest that they charge on that overdraft is dramatic. So this is becoming a profit center for the bank, and that is really their impetus for offering it, other than they may be very, very nice, and it might be also that once in a while you accidentally don't keep track of your checking account, but you sound like a very careful person, and I know that's not going to happen to you. So I applaud your efforts. You don't need that $300 balance, but for people who do and utilize that $300 overdraft balance, please keep in mind that the interest rate that the bank is charging on that is very, very high and indeed can be a major profit center for a bank. As far as credit cards, let's talk about that for a moment. There are many things that impact a credit score, and one of those is having too many credit cards, even if you don't use the credit cards, because when these credit scores are figured, what the formula is looking at is your access to credit. So if you have 6 or 7 credit cards and each one of them have a potential where you have access to $10,000 of credit, let's just say that. You've got 6 cards and you have a credit card ability to borrow up to $10,000 against each card. That's $60,000 of available credit. Now, the fact that you don't use 3 of those cards, the fact that maybe you pay off your credit cards every month, this still has a negative impact on your credit card score, on your credit score. So as a result, what I recommend to people is no more than 2 or 3 credit cards, period. You don't need to carry store credit cards because that's just additional access to credit and it negatively impacts on your credit score. So quite the contrary, if you had 4, 5, or 6 credit cards and you canceled 2 or 3, then ultimately that should improve your credit card score because it reduces the available amount of just automatic credit that is available just to you on a whim's notice, for example. So I urge people to cut down on the number of credit cards. Now, occasionally, a especially over the holidays season that we're in now, you walk into a department store and they say, golly gee, if you will just sign up for this credit card at this very, very moment, we'll give you an additional 20% or 30% off our sales prices today. I don't have a problem with that. If I'm buying a major item, maybe it's a television, maybe it's some kind of equipment, maybe it's other durables, I'll be happy to sign up for that credit card, take my 20 or 30%, put it on the darn credit card, if you will, if that's what they need me to do, and then immediately thereafter, once I get my statement and pay it, then I immediately cancel that credit card. Trust me, that's not going to have a major impact on your credit. Something else that does have a major impact on your credit, if you give a substantial number of lenders the right to check your credit. Maybe you are going to go out and borrow some money for a residential home, for an automobile, etc. If you go forum shopping to 5, 6, or 7 different places and you give them the authorization to check your credit, that's negative. That's negative. One or two places, okay, but not 6 or 7, because the theory being is that, well, gee, maybe you can't get credit at 3, 4, or 5 of these places, so you continue to go forum shopping. Those are two of the major items which impacts your credit. Obviously, you've got to pay on time, right? Even 1, 2, or 3 past dues, that is not a good thing on your credit. Now, keep in mind that you, under current law, have the absolute right to contact the major credit agencies in the United States and request information about your credit. And there are 3 major credit agencies in the United States today, and every four months, you could contact one of these organizations and request information on your credit. And as I'm sort of scrolling through some of my paperwork here, I'm trying to give you that information. If I've got it here handy, I'm not sure that I do. I'm looking for it in my book, but there is a, believe you can go to, if you just Google credit reports, national credit reports. Ah, I have it here. I actually have it here. How do I order my free credit reports? There are 3 nationwide consumer reporting companies. They have set up 1 central website or toll-free number which you can access your credit. The toll-free phone number is 877-322-8228. Or you can go online at www.annualcreditreport.com. And you can request from one of the 3 major agencies. You can actually request it from all 3 simultaneously, but since you're entitled to 1 free report a year from each of them, it would be wise to do this every 4 months at a different nationwide consumer reporting agency. You can do that. Go online, and they will send you credit information. However, interestingly enough, under the federal law, they are not required to give you your credit score. All right. If you actually want that FICO score, that Experian score, then you have to request that separately, and you got to pay typically for that, and that runs anywhere from $7 to $15. But at least we're moving in the right direction with having more access to credit information so you can check to see whether you have any negative credit information or, more importantly, any incorrect credit information, so you can jump on that and try to get it changed. So that's a little bit about credit scoring, credit agencies, access to credit.
All right. I have a couple of callers here, and we'll try to get them in the time that remains. Urbana is next, line 1. Hello.
Yes. I'm calling. The previous caller called in about checks that didn't show up. That the way to get rid of it is to call either the credit card company that's doing this to him or the utility and ask them to stop. And they will.
Okay, so yeah. You've had that experience.
Yes, I have. But, you know, they are just trying to cut down their costs by not shipping the checks around.
Well, there's no question about that. It would certainly be a cost-saving method to do everything possible technologically as opposed to with paper.
Right.
But so, you have had, in your particular case, you've had success simply calling and saying, no, I want checks.
Yes.
Great.
Yep. It worked.
Well, thank you very much. Very that good. Really helps us out.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to line three. Again, someone here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, any comments on projections like for inflation or deflation? Some say that imports provide cheap prices for stuff. Goodness, we still have a free press. They say in the tiny print that M3 is growing rapidly in numbers and percents, and some serious say that that in turn makes it likely that some things will inflate. So it's difficult to plan. Interest rates are volatile and so on and so forth.
They certainly are, and I hesitate to predict the direction of interest rates or inflation other than to say in the short run. It seems to me that the Federal Reserve has pretty clearly laid out a path where unless there is something dramatic that changes in the economy in the short run, we're headed for higher short-term interest rates, which means we're headed for higher mortgage interest rates. I don't think there's any question about that over the next 30, 60, 90 to 180 days. A year out, 2 years out, you ask 50 different economists, you may get 50 different answers. One thing that is clear, however, we seem to be in a period of time where we have higher inflation. There's no question about it. Whether oil settles at $50 a barrel or $60 a barrel, and gasoline settles at $1.50 or $2 a gallon, it's very difficult to see, at least in the short run, oil prices and gasoline dropping back to numbers that we saw 3 to 5 years ago. It just doesn't seem to be the case as we see certain global economies like China and India demanding more and more resources to actually produce more and more goods, to employ more and more people in their own economies. So as I mentioned, one thing that we can do, in the Wall Street Journal, there is a section that appears each day. It is called Money Rates. It's usually in Section B or Section C. And one of the nice items in Money Rates is to follow the Consumer Price Index, literally on a daily basis or at least on a monthly basis, and it reports retail inflation based upon government labor statistics. And what we have seen is a trend. It's simply, and it's a concerning trend, that compared to 1 year ago, if the average item that we buy is up at least a nickel from where it was a year ago, it's up 5%. That really is the bottom line. And if we look at the construction industry, when we look at natural materials, cement, wood, et cetera, things that are used in the construction industry, they're going to tell you that those things are up significantly more, 10, 11, even 12%. So I think we are in a period of time where we are seeing troubling inflation. We're seeing escalating inflation. And I think that's the major reason that the Federal Reserve, at least in the short run, is going to continue to raise short-term interest rates. Disinflation, I don't see it. I simply don't see it on the horizon at the current period of time. So if you truly believe that interest rates were going to move up, if you truly believed that inflation was going to move up, what strategies would you employ? That's really the answer. Well, you don't want to be in adjustable rate mortgages. That's clear. And 35% of all mortgages that were written last year were ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages. So long-term rates in the mortgage industry are likely to go up some more. They're now at about 6.5%. They're at two-year highs. And if people haven't locked in to 30-year rates, they better seriously think about it because they could be looking at their one-year ARMs moving up 2 percentage points over the next 3 years, 2% each year. That would be a 6% increase. That would be have a dramatic impact. So I'm concerned about people who are holding adjustable rate mortgages, and a portion of the portfolio maybe should be in hard assets. Maybe you're already an owner of real estate. I consider that a hard asset. Maybe you should be looking in some of the other areas with a small percentage of your money, perhaps even in the natural resource area. So those are some changes that we could make if we believed that, one, interest rates were going to continue to trend up, and if we believed that inflation was not far behind.
Try one more. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
Yes.
The man who just called and was talking about getting his checks, Did he mean that he's actually getting the check that he wrote instead of an image of his check?
No, I don't think so. I think he's talking about the image of the actual check. So, but in as opposed to simply having a debit show up on the bank statement, that image continued to show up. And the way to do that, apparently, according to this gentleman, was to actually call the companies and say, no, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I want the old system back. Please put me back on the old system. And then please confirm in writing. I would want a confirmation in writing that you are going to do that.
Okay. So he's getting the images of his check.
Yep. The day, I think, of people getting their checks, that's coming to an end. Maybe it still exists with some small hometown country banks, but that day really is coming to an end.
It makes me angry because I feel like I have a right to get that check back, and my transaction is not completed until I get my check back.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that way, but sometimes we just can't get our way.
Yeah, well, it's all to save money for the banks. That's what it's all about.
That's right.
Well, I'm not disagreeing.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
We're at the point we're going to have to finish up for this time around with the promise that Dave will be back next month. We'll do it again, helping you, try to help you out with some information on your financial planning. Do be very careful. Don't just do stuff because this guy says it. We want you to do as much research as you possibly can. Do your homework. And we offer this program as one place, one stop, one place that you can collect information and ask questions. And we're really always pleased to have Dave here. Dave is a clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. He's here once a month. It's always Friday. We talk about personal finance.
Dave, thanks so very much. It's just lots of fun to be with you.
Very good. The broadcast today made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. The broadcast is also made possible by the Center for Advanced Study at the University of Illinois, providing a forum for scholars to discuss issues of importance in both the academic world and the real world through programs like the MillerCom Lecture Series. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. We are going to take a break, and then we'll continue with Focus in a little bit. First, though, we'll pause for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybeans opened 6 to 8 cents lower on heavier than expected selling. We see some support in the January contract, 568.5. That tested early today, bottom out at 569 before inching its way back up. Over in the corn pit, December hit 191.5 on the